This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As Afghanistan prepares for its first presidential election, the country continues to suffer from violence and terrorism, from poverty, and from political and ethnic divisions. After 25 years of almost constant war, much of Afghanistan's infrastructure lies in ruins, and the central government's authority sometimes seems limited to the capital, Kabul. Yet, across the country, millions have turned out to register to vote in the looming election. 20 candidates have emerged to challenge the apparent favorite, Interim President Hamid Karzai, who took office in 2002 with strong American support. Often overshadowed by events in Iraq, Afghanistan is at a crucial crossroads. A successful election this October could help legitimize and stabilize the government. The consequences of failure are ominous. Today on Talk of the Nation, Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States joins us, and we'll speak with journalist Peter Bergen. He's just back from 3 weeks in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we welcome your questions about the upcoming election, security, the role of women, the power of warlords and the Taliban. If you've been to Afghanistan recently or served in the military there, we'd especially like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's begin with Peter Bergen, who's with us here in Studio 3A. He's the author of Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden. Just back last night after your visit to Afghanistan. We appreciate you coming in today, Peter.
Thank you, Neil.
Everybody says the biggest problem in Afghanistan is security. How did you find the situation there?
Well, personally, I found the situation reasonably good. Obviously, it's just my personal experience, but I drove by cab from Kandahar to Kabul, local cab, the main commercial artery of the country, which has had problems in the past. That was fine. I also drove from Kabul to the eastern border with Pakistan. I found the security situation to be okay. Now, while I was there, five people were killed by a bomb in Herat. A woman was killed in Kabul because somebody tried to attack a Western compound. I mean, there are things happening on a fairly constant basis. But I think that they are, not to be Pollyannish about this, but I think the total number of people killed by this sort of militant activity in the last year or so is about 600 people. We're sitting here in Washington. The murder rate in Washington, which is a city of 500,000 people, 300 people were killed last year approximately. So Afghanistan is a country of 22, 25 million people. I think some perspective is needed. Certainly, there are problems, but I don't think this is going to threaten the incremental steps that Afghanistan is making towards stability.
Yet we also, while you were in Afghanistan, Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, a group which has been in Afghanistan for quite some time through some very difficult periods, has said security's too bad, we can't operate, we're pulling out.
Indeed, but I think that's a very specific thing. Obviously, 32 aid workers have been killed in the past year, which is obviously not a good number, five of them from Médecins Sans Frontières. But they think that the Afghan government is not investigating in an aggressive enough way the death of these five people. That's why they're pulling out. Overall, the security situation, if you're an aid worker, obviously you're not defended, or if you're an election worker, it's problematic. I won't deny that. But I having gone there thinking that, you know, Afghanistan was in really pretty bad shape, judging by all the press reports, it's clear that the electoral registration is going incredibly well. We're looking at 60% registering in Kandahar, the former stronghold of the Taliban, 45% in Orozgan, which is Mullah Omar's own province. Those figures are based on a 1980 census. Obviously, the population is larger now. But nonetheless, you're looking at a pretty successful electoral registration drive.
What about the infrastructure? Cab ride, what was the road like?
Well, the road was, you know, I've traveled down that road under the Taliban in December of 99. It was a spine-jarring 17-hour journey, kind of a, now it's a 7-hour journey. I won't pretend it's the autobahn, but it's very different. And that's important because these roads that go from Kandahar to Kabul and also Kabul to the Pakistani border, this is the lifeblood of the Afghan economy, this kind of transport. So that is going, you know, obviously that is better.
We hear a lot about the bustle and construction underway in Kabul. What do we know about the rest of the country?
Well, in Kandahar, obviously things are very different than they were under the Taliban. I was there under the Taliban. You're also seeing a lot of construction. Kabul is now one of the world's fastest growing cities. I think a statistic that sort of speaks for itself is that since the fall of the Taliban, something like 3 million Afghans have returned to their home country from either Pakistan or Iran, and they're voting with their feet. And if there was such a major security problem that life was untenable, this wouldn't be happening.
What about the upcoming elections? What do Afghans tell you about their, obviously they're registering to vote. Are they excited about this?
I think the registering to vote is a symptom of that excitement. Obviously, it's difficult to vote. People are walking long distances, and it's also potentially dangerous to register to vote. But I think there's some very good polling data, by the way, Neil, now. Hamid Karzai, the president, is getting substantial or even overwhelming support in every province of the country, including Kandahar. And we're also seeing 82% of Afghans saying that life is better now than it was 2 years ago. These kinds of polls, this is some pretty powerful evidence that Afghans are feeling better about their lives. There's so much more to be done, but I think there is grounds for optimism.
Well, let's take a phone call, and then we'll introduce the ambassador. Our number, by the way, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Marty joins us on the line from Washington.
Hello.
Hi, Marty.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just feel like perhaps being a little over-optimistic in terms of security in Canada.
Have you been there?
Pardon?
Have you been there?
Yeah, I was there in Kandahar province doing some documentary work for USAID on the day that the war began in Iraq. And I can tell you that then there was a 48-hour lockdown for all the NGO workers doing relief and reconstruction efforts. And I've spoken to a few colleagues of mine, well, that was just over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I've spoken to a few colleagues since who've been there on contract since. And they've said, I don't know, according to a lot of the people that I've spoken with, it seems like it's gotten a lot worse.
Well, Peter, you were there recently.
Well, mine is just one experience. One thing that's interesting, one of the U.S. military officers I spoke to in Kandahar saying, we're going into areas of Zabul province, which is above Oruzgan, is a very remote area where people still think we're the Russians. I mean, it's so what?
Yeah.
One thing that's happening is people are going into areas which are they've never gone into before, and obviously that comes with some threat from former Taliban or present Taliban units. But I've got to say, it didn't feel to me like the security situation was sort of desperate or even particularly bad. Maybe I'm just willfully positive about things. I don't know.
I wouldn't say desperate, but I think just based on what I've heard, it's gotten a lot worse since then. I'll give you one example. The greatest concern that I felt in the 6 weeks that I was there was going out with a couple of fellows from the State Department to look for poppy fields. They were doing poppy eradication projects. And we actually had to hire a couple of armed guys to go with because, well, for obvious reasons. But I've since heard that you wouldn't even venture just outside Kandahar, outside the base. Now, with or without, or particularly without an armed guard or two, would you?
Well, I mean, I ventured outside the base and I went by myself and I took a local cab. Obviously, it's one person's experience, but.
All right, Marty, thanks very much.
Well, thanks. Good luck if you go back.
Okay. With us here in Studio 3 is Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States, Syed Tayeb Jawad. We appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
The picture of the security situation that we've heard from Peter Bergen has been sounding improved. Is your country ready for democratic elections?
Certainly, the country is ready for democratic elections. Afghanistan have come a long way in short 2 years. In addition to the return of the refugees, some other indicator shows that Afghanistan have made a significant achievement. We have experienced a 30% growth rate last year, continued at 20% this year, and 5 million kids are going back to school in Afghanistan. Out of 9 million people who have registered to vote, 41% are women. In some provinces in central Afghanistan, the percentage of women participating in the registration is 55%. The national average is 41%. We have introduced a new currency in the past 2 years, replacing a number of currencies that were in Afghanistan with one national currency. The process of building the national institutions is underway. 2 years ago, we didn't have any, even a single national army soldier. Today, we have about 13,000 Afghan National Army soldiers in the process of building the Afghan National Police. It's well underway. We have 20,000 a strong force of National Police Force.
And that sounds very encouraging, yet we continually hear that the Afghan government's forces would be outmanned and outgunned by the forces of any number of the warlords who control parts of the country.
This is a process of building the national institutions. Elements who are now considered as warlords were people who were part of the political process for quite some time in Afghanistan. They fought along the coalition forces against the Taliban and other elements, and some of them actually took the opportunity of being reintegrated into the political process. Others who are involved in drug trafficking and would like to continue to rule in Afghanistan by gun will be gradually pushed aside.
The drug problem, again, we've had mention of it earlier. I think that there are some estimates from the UN that Afghanistan may be supplying as much as 75% of the opium in the world today. What's to be done about this? What is President Karzai and, for that matter, his American allies doing about this?
We see a clear connection between narcotics, terrorism, and warlordism in Afghanistan. President Karzai is very much determined to move against narcotics and the drug problem in Afghanistan. We are asking the international community to mobilize all available resources in Afghanistan, being military or otherwise, in the fight against narcotics. We would like to see the fight against narcotics being a part of the fight against terrorism, because the proceeds of the narcotics do actually feed into terrorism. Afghanistan have adopted a national strategy on fighting the narcotics, and we are working on building the national institutions. The Afghan National Police Force that's being trained right now will have a special unit to fight narcotics. But this is a very complicated problem internationally, and in many other countries we are fighting this war for many, many years. And it will take some time. We have to give other opportunities for the farmers to get busy with. We have to provide for alternative livelihood and continue with the process of the DDR, which is a demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration of the militias into the civil life. As I mentioned, warlordism, drugs, and terrorism feed each other in Afghanistan.
You know, Mr. Ambassador, one thing that I heard in Afghanistan was, you've separated the elections. The presidential election is in October, and now the parliamentary election in April of next year. People are concerned that the parliamentary elections are actually going to be much more problematic than the presidential, because at the end of the day, this is all about local power. And that is something that there are a lot of interests that are going to be on either side of that.
That's absolutely right. While it's difficult to intimidate people when they are electing a president because one person has one vote, it is much easier to prevent good candidates from running in the local elections. So the concern that the future parliament of Afghanistan may include elements who will be working against the democracy in Afghanistan and against building a civil society in Afghanistan is a legitimate concern. And that's why it's important that the government and President Karzai takes more bold step against the warlords and against the elements who may actually derail the process of the progress in Afghanistan.
Well, Peter Bergen, we have to let you go and continue to recover from your jet lag. We appreciate it. Peter Bergen just returned last night from 3 weeks in Afghanistan and returned last night from Pakistan. We appreciate your time today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And when we come back after a short break, we're going to continue with your calls and email questions for Ambassador Syed Tayyeb Jawad, the ambassador of Afghanistan to the United States. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255-800-989-TALK. Email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're speaking with Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States, Syed Tayeb Jawad, about the future of his country, approaching a crossroads with presidential elections scheduled for October. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's hear from Anne. Anne is with us on the line from Baltimore.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to agree with the ambassador. Afghanistan has come a remarkably long way in 2 years, but the concern for me is who it benefits. I'm just back. I was there for 6 weeks. And I really worry about what we here are calling democracy and success in Afghanistan. And let me be really clear. I don't think it's the fault of the Afghans. I think it's the fault of the international hands who are still playing out a lot of geopolitical games using Afghanistan as a pawn.
And which hands are those?
The U.S., among others, probably is the prime, and the coalition, because what happened was it was the U.S. and the coalition who, again, re-empowered the warlords. And President Karzai has been forced to compromise with warlords for survival. And really, if you know, I was there and talking to average Afghans, and they're very concerned about what's going to happen, about whether he can be strong enough. And they're beginning to question some of a lot of what's happening and what's going to happen with these elections.
Let's ask the ambassador. As Anne says, has the United States played a role in re-empowering the warlords?
Well, when the September 11 tragedy happened, the United States was forced to come to Afghanistan to defend itself, to defend Afghanistan, to defend the world. And there was some short-term objective on that time that has to be achieved, which included the defeating Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and freeing Afghanistan from the menace of terrorism. That necessitated to work with some elements on the ground, some forces that were there and volunteered their services to fight and work alongside the United States forces. That was a successful short-term objective, but this fact is actually now running contrary to the long-term objective of stability of Afghanistan. Some of these groups were, during the war against Taliban and Al-Qaeda, gained some power and legitimacy. And it's now up to the international community to assist the Afghan people, the Afghan government, to push aside those elements who are preventing Afghanistan to move toward democracy and to build a civil society in the country.
And where were you in Afghanistan?
I was in Kandahar. I was in Kabul and then some provinces north of Kabul. Unfortunately, because of security, I couldn't travel around as much as I wanted. You know, the NGOs have curfews. The UN has a curfew. There's restricted restaurant lists. There are people talking about closing up for the 6 weeks around elections. Unfortunately, the Afghan people are not going to have those protections. They have to stay. And so the internationals will find some safety and security. But everyone's really worried about what's going to happen around elections in terms of violence and security.
Yes. And thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. Okay, here's an email question from Art in San Francisco. Just yesterday, there was a story on National Public Radio relating how Mr. Karzai is inviting Taliban officials back to Afghanistan and back to the government. How does the ambassador feel about this, and how does he fit this into saying that it's so much better after the departure of the Taliban?
President Karzai has not invited the Taliban or the Taliban leadership to come to Afghanistan. As part of the peace process in Afghanistan, a number of the group, a political group, individuals and others have come to Kabul, have asked for discussion about the situation in Afghanistan with President Karzai. President Karzai welcomed those all Afghans to participate in the new process of peace and stability in Afghanistan. We do not want to give a recruiting ground for the terrorists by shutting down a group of the Afghans who are out there. They are Afghans, they are citizens of this country, and particularly those who have not committed any crimes under the new constitution of Afghanistan, which is one of the most enlightened constitutions in the region. They have certain rights, and the Afghan government, the President Karzai and others, would like to see these rights being protected.
Let's talk now with Ellen, and Ellen's on the line from Gaithersburg, Maryland. Excuse me.
Hello, Ambassador Jawad. Jawad, you've done a phenomenal job, and I thank you. My question is based on my experience in Kabul. I was there for 3 months last summer at the Rabia Balkhi Maternity Hospital, and I repeated my visit again this winter for 3 months at the same place, Rabia Balkhi Maternity Hospital and Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital. I'm very concerned about what I witness as abuse of U.S. aid. Specifically, We have no equipment in that hospital. I brought in, on my own, $1,600 worth of equipment and built up the nursery, as the ambassador knows, and Peter Saleh, his deputy, know. And the government provided me with no funds at all, nothing. There's money that was distributed to the DHHS through the Gates Foundation that is going through an NGO that never got to the people. And I'd like to know what Karzai plans to do about this injustice, because we have millions of dollars going into quote-unquote aid through NGOs and not through foreign aid directly to Karzai. And an evidence of this is on August the 3rd, 2 days ago, there was the Leapfrog talking book that was distributed to the people of Afghanistan with minimal research and development, believe me, because the people in Afghanistan lack the basic healthcare needs. And this book was produced at a cost of $1.2 million for 20,000 books that are battery-operated when these people have nothing. The congenital anomaly rate is horrendous there.
Well, let's give the ambassador a chance to respond.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your kind word, and thank you very much for your assistance and commitment to Afghanistan. We appreciate very much committed individuals such as you or devoting their time to Afghanistan. I agree with you that the health sector in Afghanistan is really in a very bad situation. On my speech on that day when this book was introduced, I told that patients in Afghanistan have to bring their own medication and syringes to the clinics that lack everything.
Yeah.
Of course, we are moving gradually toward acquiring more Afghan ownership of these projects, but we can do this only gradually because, frankly, we also do not have the capacity to manage all these projects. Lack of human capital, lack of qualified Afghan to run project is one of our serious issues. Hopefully, by millions of kids now today going to Afghanistan, with 18 universities being operational in Afghanistan, we will have a number of qualified Afghan to take ownership of these projects and reduce the overhead expenses of some of the NGOs and other institutions who are operating expensively in Afghanistan.
Well, I'd like to speak about the Afghans, because I met several Afghans that were very qualified to run and take ownership of their programs. They were repatriated either from Pakistan or from the United States. Kudrat Mojadidi, Rahim Pushtunyar, who are both American Afghans. You also have people from Afghanistan. And the problem is that we have American expats over there that are in positions of authority, and these people are doing nothing. They're working. An Afghan physician will work as an interpreter or a driver and not providing health care. And this is an issue that really needs to be addressed.
Ellen, thanks very much for raising it.
Okay, thank
you. Appreciate the phone call. I did want to ask a question about diplomatic relations. This week, the Afghan government produced a teenage Pakistani prisoner who said he had been trained in Pakistan by a militant Islamic group expressly to attack American and Afghan forces in Afghanistan. Dr. Zalmay Khalilzad, the American ambassador to Afghanistan, your counterpart, has stated publicly Pakistan has not done nearly enough to stop the Taliban and other militants from using Pakistan's border areas as operational and recruiting areas. What's happening with this? What are your relations with Pakistan like, and is Pakistan, in your government's view, doing enough to stop this cross-border action?
We would like to have the best possible relation with Pakistan. We have tried everything to improve the relation between the two countries. We see the future of Afghanistan, a future of the region, in further trade and interaction with all our neighbors. Pakistan is being cooperating more and more in the area of fighting against terrorism, but certainly there's a lot more need to be done. While the cooperation at the Al-Qaeda level in the Arab elements is much more sincere, when it comes to the Taliban, it looks like sometimes they look away, and some of the cross-border infiltration that takes place in Afghanistan is a clear evidence that Taliban have found a sanctuary in there. And in the case of Mr. Sohail, that the Afghan government presented to the media, that was very clear. He was recruited not from the tribal area in Karachi and trained outside Islamabad and sent to Afghanistan. And there are more cases like that. And we are really concerned about that, because extremism and fundamentalism and is a danger for Afghanistan, for Pakistan, for the people of Pakistan, for the region. We would like to see an end to this trend because we were a victim of terror in Afghanistan. We know how dangerous it would be to nourish these kind of elements, these kind of groups, the fundamentalists, the extremists, and the Taliban. It will be a dangerous game that will endanger the entire region.
Let me just, for point of emphasis, you say that Pakistan is doing well on al-Qaeda, but not so well on the Taliban. You're suggesting that Taliban has considerable support in Pakistan.
Taliban has not support in Pakistan, but there are elements in Pakistan that are supporting Taliban, and Taliban are operating along the tribal belt, but also in major cities such as Quetta and Karachi. Pakistan can do a lot more in containing the activities of the Taliban.
Okay, let's get another caller involved in the conversation. This is Greg, who's on the phone with us from Lansing, Michigan.
Hi, and hi to the ambassador, and thanks for talking with us, sir.
You're welcome, sir.
My question has to do with the opium poppy crop. I would like to know two things. Has President Karzai and the government been receiving help in the form of researchers who might be looking for other crops that might do well there from the United States? And I would like to know why, if other than security considerations, the United States could not just simply purchase the crop from the growers. While trying to establish alternative agricultural activities.
Is that an option? Could the United States or other outside, other countries just purchase this opium crop and keep it out of the hands of warlords, drug traffickers, and terrorists you referred to earlier, Mr. Ambassador?
This is an option that's being discussed in Afghanistan, but we have to be really careful about that. 2 years ago, we paid cash for the destruction of the poppy crop. It had an adverse effect. In many instances, the farmer thought that if they grow poppies, someone will come in, will destroy the field and pay them in cash. So that was for them an easy way of farming. So it turned out to be more of an incentive to do more instead of reducing the production of narcotics and the cultivation of poppy. But we've also looked into substitute crop in Afghanistan. Some of the high-value products, such as saffron that grows in Afghanistan, in cumin, are a good substitute for poppy. But overall, as I mentioned, it has to be a comprehensive, a wholesome approach. We have to destroy the labs that are in Afghanistan. We have to provide for alternative livelihood, and we have to come up with substitute crop.
And following up on Greg's question, have you determined what might a substitute crop be, other than saffron?
Cotton is another product that we have looked into. But again, it's really, by the end of the day, it's very difficult to come up with anything else that pay as much as poppy.
Ambassador, has the United States? I don't know what department does this, AID or whoever. Been researching, been there looking at the agricultural land with the idea of trying to figure out what would work. Have you been getting USA help agriculturally in the area?
We are getting agricultural aid from the United States, but particular projects of substitute crops such as rose water or cumin or saffron are being discussed. There are no specific project or specific fund allocated to implement those.
I see. But you're satisfied, though, the United States is giving you adequate research assistance in this regard?
More could be done in this regard. This is a common fight, and more could be done.
Greg, right, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. Our guest is Ambassador Syed Tayeb Jawad, the ambassador to the United States from Afghanistan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with John. John's on the line from Des Moines, Iowa.
Yes, Your Excellency. How are you doing?
Thank you very much.
My question is, you'd have to forgive me, as I do not know much about the Afghanistan and especially its internal workings, but I do know that in a little bit about Muslim areas, but that some of them are suppressing minority religions that are not Muslim, and I was kind of curious as to in how the different tribes, how they are interacting, and how the interactions among the different sects of Islam are, as in Sunniism, Sufism, Wahhabism, and how the Muslims as a whole are respecting minorities such as Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity.
That's a very good question. In Afghanistan, we have Shia, Sunni. We have a small minority of Hindus. We used to have a small minority of Jews that, unfortunately, during the Soviet invasion and the war thereafter, had left. Some of them are living in New York City and other places, but they're still interested in Afghanistan and what's going on in Afghanistan. The new constitution of Afghanistan provides for full protection of religion other than Islam. They can worship and practice whatever the religion they practice, and also the new constitution provides for equal rights for the members of the Shia or the Sunni sect of Islam. Follower of the Shia sect in Afghanistan are entitled to have court procedures in accordance with the Shia fiqh. So the new constitution does recognize these rights.
John, thanks for the question.
Thank you.
And before we let you go, Mr. Ambassador, we did want to ask you also, not so much about the security situation, as you look at relations with the United States, clearly now a very important player in Afghanistan at the moment, and at the efforts of NATO countries. Are you getting enough from the NATO countries in particular to expand their security operations beyond Kabul? Would you like to see more troops arrive from NATO countries?
Certainly, we would like to see more troops coming in. At the NATO summit in Istanbul, NATO promised to increase their troops from 6,500 to 10,000. This has not been materialized yet. There are some discussions that they will keep about 2,000 of those soldiers outside country as a reserve. NATO certainly can do more. Afghanistan is an issue where the entire world actually agree that assistance and further assistance and accelerated assistance are needed. But sometimes when it comes to the delivery of these assistance, we see a delay. And particularly with the elections coming up, it's crucial that additional NATO troops are sent to Afghanistan to make sure that the Afghan people, who are very optimistic about their country, about their future, who are registering their record number, are given a chance to participate in this process.
Ambassador, thanks very much for being with us today. We thank you for your time. Ambassador Syed Tayyeb Jawad, Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States, was with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we'll be talking about how homeland security funds are distributed in this country. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.